Okay, thanks, Bodley Leila. So yes, he was born. So the legend goes in a lotus in a lake, and he was discovered on the lotus by King Indrabhuti, who was a blind king. So obviously it was his court who discovered the child, and he was adopted by Indrabhuti. Indrabhuti was also heirless. He didn't have any children, so he adopts this child that he's found on the lotus in the lake, and he brings up the child with a view to the child becoming his heir. So there are echoes here of the story of the Buddha out there. So that the Buddha was born into a life of luxury. His father was a king. Or a head chieftain, and like wise Indrabhuti tries to bring up Padmasambhava in a life of luxury, but Padmasambhava is having none of it. As a teenager, he just doesn't go along with the mores, the conventional behavior of someone growing up in the court. He does outrageous things from their point of view. You know, he dances naked, almost naked, on the rooftops, with wearing nothing but bone ornaments, and with his hair dishevelled, and he's obviously, his character is heading in a different direction, towards rather than towards kingship. Anyway, there are various stories where he really upsets the court to a point where the king is forced to exile him, and kick him out of the court. Padmasambhava heads off. And where does he go after being kicked out from the court? But to the local cremation ground, called the Chili Grove Cremation Ground. As you do if you're kind of this exceptional being that Padmasambhava is. Now, cremation grounds are charnel grounds. What sort of places are these? Not comfortable places, you know, not with any of the comforts of a homemade oat milk latte, fresh with freshly ground Colombian beans. What you're surrounded with in a cremation ground is death, the smells of death, the bodies left over. I have an image here which might reinforce the the picture a bit. Yeah, so there are some bodies have not fully decomposed, some have not been fully burnt. You know, it's a cremation ground. So here that we see vultures eating the dead. So it's got this mix in this image of a sky burial where the bodies are left out for animals, jackals to consume, and for the vultures to eat. So this is obviously, we're not in downtown Croydon or anywhere here. We're in the east centuries ago, and it's a pretty horrific scene. We'd see the skeletons and wild animals and blood. These are not comfortable places, cremation grounds. It's a place to encounter discomfort. The very opposite of what could describe as worldly desires, maybe scary places as well. Maybe, you know, if you go to graveyards, you know, much toned down version of a cremation ground, but they still can have a certain atmosphere about them, and maybe lonely places, fearful and lonely. But there are perhaps, certainly back in the day in eastern, northeastern India, you may have come across these characters. And we see one here with his Damaru drum, and his blowing his, it's probably a thigh bone trumpet, sitting in kind of meditation posture, a siddhi sort of. I mentioned that the tantric tradition was started by these wandering ascetics. Well, not so much ascetics, and that's the wrong word. Spiritual seekers who kind of rebelled against the more established monastic setup of the time, and they they frequented cremation grounds. So in a sense, Padmasambhava is following in a well-established tradition for these cities to go to cremation grounds for many, many reasons. So one of the reasons is that these cities place themselves outside of society. In Indian society of the time, you would be regarded as impure if you frequented a cremation ground. These are impure places. So it's kind of dropping any desire to be approved of by society. It's kind of embracing a taboo, going out onto the edge, really, that these cremation grounds often were and still are on the edges of towns. It's turning one's back on conventional society. And maybe more importantly, seeking out an encounter, face-to-face encounter with death. Looking death really squarely in the face. I mean, it's quite an old tradition, isn't it, of reminding ourselves of our impermanence. And we've been hearing this morning about the importance of reminding ourselves of impermanence. You know, Padmasambhava's teaching to the three fortunate women. First, start by contemplating impermanence, he says. But there's a long tradition in Buddhism that of contemplating death and impermanence as a way for us to really appreciate the urgency of getting on with life, that it's short. In the Middle Ages, you had these sorts of images of a dance with death. You know, these are Holbein, I believe. So death appears in various places in the street. So death is a, let me just see, yeah. Death is a salutary, to every now and again at least contemplate the possibility of our own impermanence is a salutary practice according to Buddhism. But we also find here in the cremation ground, we find Padmasambhava. This Padmasambhava has many different appearances, as I mentioned yesterday, and this is one of them where he is in the cremation ground. I don't know if you can see with some of the scary beings down at the bottom here. We have a lion-headed, a yak-bodied, snake-legged being, and we have various. We have a demon, and we've bodies and decomposing and animals consuming. But we also have this figure, the Dakini, who is keeping Padmasambhava company, and Padmasambhava is teaching. His finger there, it looks like he's demonstrating something, some teaching to the Dakini. And we'll come back to the Dakinis, very interesting denizens of the cremation ground. But we'll come back to them. But let us consider, reflect on what the cremation grounds might mean for us. I mean, it's not often that we might get to a cremation ground. We could perhaps visualize them. But what do they represent? Generally, they're recognized as representing a crucial situation. And we all have come across crucial situations in our daily lives. So any confrontation with illness or failure or blame, loss of reputation, any loss really, and of course we're all perhaps experiencing some form of loss during this pandemic, whether it's loved ones at one end of the scale, or just our freedoms, our ability to hug people. If you like hugs, maybe you're feeling a bit hug deprived, or you know, that those basic freedoms of free movement, free association, maybe there's a loss, surely. Or maybe another crucial situation can simply be the fear of loss, you know, the fear. So situations where we go out of our comfort zone and there's fear in there that we might lose something, whether it's reputation or financial or whatever. Just an example would be sort of when I'm preparing a talk, there's always a bit of there's excitement, but there's also it's mixed up with a bit of fear. I don't know, the fear is probably around making a fool of myself or whatever in front of people that I respect. So the crucial situation can, you know, there are some extreme and some, you know, we'll be meeting crucial situations probably on a regular basis. But what they represent really, what a crucial, that the common factor in a crucial situation is the factor of change. So again, we're focusing on impermanence here. Because change brings us, forces us to go into the unknown, really. It's a reminder of insecurity. It challenges our ego. So we all have this self-construct. And part of our sense of self is it's stable and it's independent. And Buddhism teaches us that this stability and independence are actually fantasies. And in a sense, the ego really knows that deep down it's insubstantial. So its response is to constantly seek out some sort of secure ground. And it does that by identifying with, you know, possessions, with views, with maybe some of our habits, and the expressions of those habits, like opinions and, you know, views. So how, you know, let us say that the crucial situation is not just dramatic, it's also those everyday experiences of change. You could therefore say in a sense the whole world or mundane experience is a cremation ground. In a sense, there is nothing really solid to hold on to. And we face these challenges on a moment-to-moment, day-by-day basis. So from a positive point of view then, we can look on the cremation ground, these crucial situations, as these challenges, as a training ground, an opportunity, the arena for our spiritual development. In a sense, they are a call to us to evolve, to grow, to go beyond the limitations that we in our narrow self views impose on ourselves, and the narrow limiting stories that we develop. The Shantideva, I think it was 8th century monk, says in the Bodhicaryavatara, writes in the Bodhicaryavatara, the virtue of suffering has no rival, since from the shock it causes, intoxication falls away, and there arises compassion for those in cyclic existence. So there's a sense that these challenges, these difficulties, that the suffering that they give rise to are valuable opportunities for growth, for turning out from our limited self and expanding our view to include others. They're also kind of a source from a tantric point of view. Each and every one of these challenges are sources of direct experience of what we truly are in our depth. And there's, if we can tap into that, if we can connect with that and actually live from that, there's the possibility of radical transformation. And the Tantra would say there's nothing in our experience which should be left out. It's all grist to the mill of our spiritual development. The question is, the crucial question in the crucial situation is how do we actually face the challenges? There's a quote that I really like from Viktor Frankl's Will to Meaning. He says, man's freedom is no freedom from conditions. Or you could read just challenges in there for conditions. Man's freedom is no freedom from challenges, but rather freedom to take a stand on whatever challenges might confront him. So his freedom is rather to take a stand on whatever challenges might confront him. So we can take a stand. We can, on the one hand, resist the suffering, the discomfort, the pain in our knees. You know, we can resist it. We can try and block it out. We can resist through craving and aversion. But actually, all these efforts to block out the suffering just add to the suffering. That they add another level of suffering. The fact is that change is inevitable. So the alternative strategy for in this crucial situation is to accept change. by turning towards it. And that's the key phrase. And I think that's what the cremation ground is, really. It's a place in which we turn towards. It's a place of turning towards. How do we turn towards? Well, Buddhism offers us the teaching of the radical teaching of turning towards in the shape of mindfulness. So we turn towards our bodies, just as we were doing yesterday morning and this morning in meditation. We turn towards our bodies. Interestingly, Padmasambhava grounds himself next to a stupa when he's in the cremation ground. You might have noticed in that last image or tanka, he was holding himself up against a stupa. And the stupa is one of these, it represents the Buddha. It's kind of a monument to the Buddha. And it has many symbolic, as you'd expect, coming out of the Buddhist tradition. There's many symbols attached to it. And different parts of the stupa represent the elements. So that image of Padmasambhava resting on the elements is a sense that he grounds himself in his body, in the physical elements. And what that helps us to do, by really engaging with our physical sensations, by dropping into our bodies, it creates a kind of spaciousness around our experience. If we're going through some difficult emotional turmoil, we ground ourselves in our body, and that helps us just to take some of the heat off the emotion, to create what's often described as a bigger container, and like a more spacious situation where we can notice our response to the challenge. We can take in, how am I either reacting or responding to this challenge? And we can, through mindfulness, dwell in the gap. So we have the stimulus, we have that experience of, this is unpleasant, or this is really pleasant. And we can just notice that. We can leave it, that we can bring our awareness to bear, shine the light of awareness on that, and then notice our reaction to the pain or the pleasure. So the gap is between the pain, pleasure, and the aversion, craving that might respond in the resistant response to the challenge, the pain. We might also notice in the gap, whatever about our reactions, so actually some of our reactions might constitute our demons. For example, sometimes when we're really in a difficult situation, we just revert to our normal comforts, I don't know, or addictions. Maybe it's a cigarette, or it's a drink, or a nice cup of latte when under pressure. That addiction, it kind of represents a stuck energy. It's like a habitual fallback, and it's familiar. There's a comfort to it. It's familiar, but it's like a stuck record. We just go back to it again and again. It's like water flowing down a rut. You know, it's our energies are just in a very narrow, defined, habitual flow. And there are stories, you know, the demons might manifest as, you know, I'm not good enough. They don't like me. I'm not appreciated. If we notice any aversion or clinging, habitual aversion or clinging, you know, there's energy bound up with that. That's the demon. That's the demon. But if we, in this spaciousness, if we can create the spaciousness through mindfulness and illuminate the situation with awareness between the gap, between the stimulus, the pain and the pleasure and the response, there's the possibility of transformation. There's a possibility, in one way of putting it, is that the experience, the reaction, the demon self-liberates, and the energy associated with it can then flow freely, not down the rut of habit, down that channel that it usually goes down, but it can be, we have some choice as to how to direct it. We can direct the energy so that it's going in a creative direction. We choose the direction it flows down. So we're directing the change. So it's like, okay, the situation, this crucial situation is change. And we can't get away from change. But if we can direct the change through illuminating the difficulty with awareness, then we're taking the bull by the horns. We're directing, we're embracing the change. And you could say this is the task of the spiritual life, really. We're getting into the driving seat, we're forming new habits. We develop positive habits, new stories. You know, I'm a very adaptable person. I can deal with this. I'm a very lovable person. I'll be fine. I've got lots of friends who will help me out. And, you know, these sorts of stories that will be a support to us, a strength to us, even going into the unknown. And then rather than being a threatening situation, it can be an exhilarating situation. And the sorts of habits we can develop out of it are the heroic qualities like fearlessness, confidence, initiative, spirit of adventure, resilience. So the cremation ground, this crucial situation, is a place of turning towards through mindfulness. But it's also a place, you could say, of letting go. So we turn towards and then we let go. So the term spiritual death is often applied to the experience of really productively using the crucial situation. It's spiritual death is a kind of radical letting go of whatever we identify with. You know, those habits, those views, those opinions, those demons. You know, sometimes we are attached to our demons because they're familiar and that they provide some security because of their familiarity. You know, addictions often play that role. So this radical letting go can actually mean an acceptance of something that you've lost. So I don't know, maybe during the pandemic you've lost something and it was a struggle just to acknowledge, okay, that's gone. So sometimes the letting go can be just an acceptance, a kind of a renunciation, which can then be a liberation because it's freely given, the assent, the consent. Okay, while the thing may have been taken from you without your choice, your letting it go can be your choice rather than, as I often do, I kind of hold back and still kind of mull over the loss and think, oh, if only I had done this or that the other, then it wouldn't have happened this way. You know, that story that I beat myself up with around, if only I had done this or done that. If I can just let go of that story, that's kind of a renunciation and a liberation. So this dwelling in the cremation ground and turning towards letting go is a kind of dwelling in the dark, I would say. It's not comfortable. So it seems reasonable to look for any support we can get. And obviously Sangha, community, is one of those sources. Friendship, spiritual friendship, is one of those very accessible supports we have available to us, hopefully. But there's also the possibility in the mythical realm of calling on Padmasambhava, the Lord of dark places, the master of demons, who represents the possibility of change, of transformation. That he's an archetype of this aspect of the enlightened mind. So we're calling on our own internal possibility, our own potential for change and transformation. So we can call on Padmasambhava and ask him to help us through this process of turning towards and letting go. maybe you can engage in devotional practices or find tankas, those images of Padmasambhava, and use them as gateways to accessing that energy within yourself. Or you can sort of engage in the sort of meditation or visualization we did yesterday, where we laid down our demon in front of the Padmasambhava. So it was in his gaze, it was in our gaze. So what we're looking for here in calling on Padmasambhava is to liberate our energies, to transform our demons so that we can wield the energy that is caught up in them. As I was saying yesterday, we want to generate this free flowing energy, which is we can dispose of, we can wield, we can be creative with, so that this energy, once liberated, once the demon is on our side and converted, it can that the energy that was locked up can flow in a direction of our choice, free of compulsion, and available therefore to direct behind our highest values. Now, this free-flowing energy is the archetype that's often used to represent this free-flowing energy is the Dakini. And I'll just put the Dakinis down for a moment, because I think it's about time that we just broke up into groups for, actually before that, we'll do a bit of reflection before we, just as a preparation for the groups. So I'll pick up the thread of Dakinis, in case your curiosity has been whetted. But let's first just explore some of the material that we've gone over, the crucial situation, the cremation ground, as a place of turning towards letting go and releasing the energies that are, so that they're available to us. Okay, so I invite you just to find a position, a posture, in which you're comfortable, sitting or lying down, whichever works for you, and we'll do some minutes of reflection. In a sense, this reflection is just to prime us for going into the groups. So I'll drop in a few some questions and invite you to just relate the questions to your own experience. So what are my cremation grounds? What are my crucial situations? In my crucial situations, in my cremation grounds, what do I need to turn towards in order to thrive and grow? in my crucial, challenging situations, what do I need to let go of in order to thrive and grow? So what do I need to let go of in order to thrive and grow? What might my liberated energies, my free-flowing energy, look like? So how would that free-flowing, liberated energy manifest in my life? Okay, we'll close the reflection stage at this point. And we'll go into groups. So, Bodhilila, if we could have 20 minutes for the groups whenever you're ready. See you all back in 20 minutes. So can I just check with Alana and Rebecca and Zoe and Julia that you...
It's okay. I'm just in the process of doing it there. Yeah, don't worry.
Okay.
So everybody who asks not to be in a group, I'm going to put you in the waiting room now until the others come back.
Thanks, Claudia.
So, Yulia, you didn't make a request not to be in a group, but seeing as you haven't wanted or joined the previous groups, I'm just going to move you into the waiting room. Just give you a minute. If you want to change your mind, you can still click on join the group.
Good, thank you, Bodhi Leela.
Okay, just making sure. Okay, there's one that just has three, so I'm going to join it.
Okay. So the groups are finishing, they're 20 minutes, so they'll finish at 5:30. So are you happy to send a message at 5:25 to... Okay. Om Vajrayoginium Patswaha. Om Vajra Yogini Om 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 Patswaha. Om Aho Vajra Guru Padma Siddhi Hum. Om Aho. Om Aho. Om Aho Vajra Guru Padma Siddhi Hum. Om Aho. Om Aho. Om Aho Vajra Guru Padma Siddhi Hum. Om Aho. Om Aho. Om Aho Vajra Guru Padma Siddhi Hum. Om Aho. Om Aho Vajra Guru Padma Siddhi Hum. Om Aho. Om Aho. Om Aho Vajra Guru Padma Siddhi Hum. Om Aho. Om Aho. Om Aho Vajra Guru Padma Siddhi Hum. Om Aho. Om Aho. Om Aho Vajra Guru Padma Siddhi Hum. Om Aho. Om Aho. Om Aho Vajra Guru Padma Siddhi Hum. Om Aho. Om Aho. Om Aho Vajra Guru Padma Siddhi Hum. Om Aho. Om Aho. Om Aho Vajra Guru Padma Siddhi Hum. Om Aho. Om Aho. Om Aho Vajra Guru Padma Siddhi Hum. city. Here we go. Hello, Daniela.
Hi.
Oh,
am I the only one?
Are we finished already?
Yes.
Okay.
Is it all for everyone to finish? I thought we were meeting as a group.
Yeah. Looks like everybody's back, yeah.
Yeah. We have 16, 27, yeah, people are coming back.
Great.
Thank you so much for the talk, Radna Deva. Thank you.
You're very welcome, Daniela. So, good. This is an opportunity then to bring, share any of the issues that might have come up in your groups. If there's anything you want to share, or any questions you might have around the cremation grounds, or interesting experiences that you had, then you'd like to share. In relation to crucial situations or anything you might think might be helpful for other people to hear. I'd be very glad to, if you might share it.
Radna Deva, I'm happy to share just my experience in terms of liberation of energy. So I think over the last few months,